Psalms 104:24, David said, O Lord, how manifold are thy works. In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. David understood what the evolutionist does not, that the wonders of nature did not come about by happen chance. They were designed and created by a wise, omniscient, almighty God. It is the fool that cannot see this. Oh, he may be a doctor. He may have a whole string of degrees after his name. He may teach at some prestigious university. But if he does not understand that this world was created by God, he is simply an educated fool. There are many people in this world that have a doctorate degree. That in no way proves their wisdom or their knowledge. Simply proves that they have been educated or that they have gone to school longer than the average person. David said that the earth is full of God's riches. Solomon said that no man can find out all the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. There is just simply too much. There are so many things about our world that we will never know. So many things that we will never discover. But what has been discovered, what we do know, is nothing short of remarkable. This morning I want to look at insects. And in that regard, I use the word in its broader sense, that which includes spiders and ticks and centipedes, etc., rather than in its more narrow and technical sense, which would exclude those creatures. Plain and simple, we're going to look at bugs this morning. Even in the insect world, there is remarkable evidence for a master designer, a master creator. The things that insects have been equipped to do, the abilities and innate knowledge that has been placed in their tiny heads is an embarrassment to evolutionists. Consider the Australian trapdoor spider. He lives in a home that has wall-to-wall silk carpeting made by the spider himself. His home, though literally a hole in the ground, is waterproof and insect-proof. He has a specially engineered lid on his home that gives him his name, the trapdoor spider. That trapdoor is camouflaged, the color around it, color of the ground around it, flecked with little bits of moss and leaves and twigs. The spider doesn't build his home anywhere. He chooses a high spot where the rain won't accumulate into puddles. Even though his home is waterproof, he doesn't want a surprise shower when he opens his door to go out for the day. When the spider has his home site chosen, he begins to bite the earth and remove the soil to another place. His mouth makes a great shovel with a row of teeth on the bottom jaw and two fangs, and with that he uses it to scoop up earth. Keeps digging until he has a hole 1 foot deep and 1.5 inches wide. Then he covers the floor and the walls with silk, 1/8 of an inch thick. The trapdoor spider has several liquid silk glands. The spider takes the silk that his body makes, and with his hind legs, he twists several strands of it together to make one strong strand, just like we make rope today. When air strikes the silk strand, it dries and becomes strong and elastic-like. Time and again, the spider does this until his entire house is covered with silk carpet. The carpet keeps him warm and dry and keeps other insects from being able to burrow into his home. After the home has been made, it's time to make a door. The spider searches around for a piece of sun-baked mud. When he finds a piece about 2 inches across, 2 inches wide, he drags it over to his home. And with his sharp teeth and fangs, he cuts it in the shape of a circle, a little bigger than the opening of his house. He doesn't need a tape measure. He can eyeball it and cut it to the right size. The spider then chips away at that door that he has cut until it is about 1/4 of an inch thick. He then bevels the top of it. He cuts a bevel on the lid of the door. And then he bevels the outer rim of the door frame on his house. Without measuring like we do, the spider cuts those beveled edges perfectly and they fit exactly. Then the trapdoor spider waterproofs his door, covering it with more strands of silk, liquid silk, which hardens and covers the door. Then he drags the door over to the edge of his hole. He climbs inside the hole and pulls the door shut over him. Down there in the dark of his hole, he puts a hinge on the door. He spins a silk hinge, attaching one end to the top of to one side of the door, the other side to the other end of the top of his silk hole. Over and over and over he does this, strand after strand, until he knows that his hinge is strong enough. The trapdoor spider pushes the lid of his home open with his head and he crawls out. The door closes snugly behind him. But he doesn't want that. He wants to be able to bring a bug home for dinner and not have to mess with opening the door. He wants to be able to get away from enemies quickly and not have to stop and open the door if he needs to run down into his home quickly. So he puts a weight just over the top of the hinge. He has to know how much weight to put there. If he puts too much weight, the door will stay open, be too hard to close. If he puts too little weight, then the door won't pop open when he wants to go out and he bumps it with his head. He has to balance the door and the weight and the hinge. Engineers call that weight over the hinge a counterbalance. After the weight is glued on, he makes a little silk handle on the underside of the door so he can pull the door shut. That handle comes in handy. It may save the spider's life. For when the hunting wasp finds a trapdoor spider's house, he tries to force his way in. The spider braces himself against the walls of his house and hangs onto the doorknob until the wasp gets discouraged and leaves. Once the door is finished, the spider finds little bits of moss and leaves and glues them to the door so that it blends in perfectly with the ground around it. In fact, when the spider goes for a long walk, he trails a line of silk from his burrow, which he follows back so he can find his own home again. Once in his home, he cracks the door open a little bit and waits for bugs to come strolling by. All of that brilliant engineering ability placed within a little brown spider that's barely an inch long, placed there by Almighty God. Now, evolutionists don't spend a lot of time talking about the Australian trapdoor spider because their theory teaches that we are evolving, getting better, getting smarter, increasing our ability, and that lower life forms are simple and far less advanced. Let me show you how desperate they are. This is from an article in Parade magazine by Carl Sagan, one of the leading evolutionists of our day. He says, "We humans are the dominant species on the planet. Why us? Of all the promising life forms, why did one primate species, naked, puny, and vulnerable, manage to subordinate all the rest and to make this world and others its domain? Why are we so different? Or are we?" Most of the philosophers, conventionally adjudged great, thought that humans are fundamentally different from the other animals because of an immaterial, quote-unquote, something for which no scientific evidence has been produced that resides somewhere in the bodies of humans but in no one else on Earth. It is not enough that humans have a different assortment of the qualities evident in the other animals, more of some traits, fewer of others. A radical difference in kind, not some fuzzy-edged difference in degree, is needed, longed for, sought. The uniqueness of humans has been claimed on many grounds, but most often because of our tool-making, culture, language, reason, and morality. We have them, the other animals don't, and so the argument goes, that's that. Then he goes on to give a description of a chimpanzee. Blasé, matter of fact, she carefully positions the hard-shelled fruit on the log and smashes it open, using a stone tool procured for the purpose, hammer and anvil. No light bulb goes off above her head. There's no chin to fist, no hint of insight struggling to emerge, no moment of revelation. It's just another routine, humdrum thing that chimps do. Only humans who know where tools can lead find it remarkable. Although many chimps literally do not know enough to come in out of the rain, they're able to use tools. Not only that, they're able to make tools and premeditate their use. A chimp breaks off a long grass stalk or a reed so she may use it later, hundreds of meters away, more than an hour in the future, to lure delectable termites out of a log or termite mound. She must remove superfluous leaves and twigs, shape it, shorten it, insert it into the termite tunnel with a deft twisting motion to follow the interior contours, shake it seductively to attract termites onto it, and then with great care remove it without scraping off too many. Chimps take years to perfect their technique and routinely teach it to their young who are avid pupils. How difficult is chimpanzee termite fishing? What depths of intellect and manual dexterity are required? Suppose you were dropped naked into the Gombe National Park in Tanzania and, like it or not, discovered that termites are your principal hedge against malnutrition or starvation. You know they're an excellent source of protein. You know that self-respecting humans, whatever that is, in many parts of the world regularly eat them. You manage to put aside whatever compunctions you may feel. But catching them one at a time is not going to be worth the effort. You're going to have to make a tool, repeatedly insert it into their meter-high mound, and introduce the tool into your mouth and strip off the clinging termites with your teeth and lips as you withdraw the tool from your mouth. Could you do as well as a chimp? The anthropologist Gize Tlike tried to find out. He spent months in Gombe under the tutelage of a chimp named Leakey. The chimp is his teacher. Tlike found out that after months of intensive effort, he hadn't a clue to finding the entrances to the mounds that the termites wall up each evening and that the chimps effortlessly uncover in the morning. He couldn't select the best stalks, prepare them, or insert and withdraw them so termites would be clinging to them. He failed miserably. It's a little daunting to discover, on the very technological grounds on which human superiority is claimed, that after months of apprenticeship, human scientists cannot do as well as pre-adolescent chimps. Maybe that just tells us something about scientists. Here's a picture. The picture says a chimp strips delicious insects off a wooden tool it has manufactured and with great facility inserted into a termite mound. An anthropologist spent months trying to learn the skills of the chimpanzee termite fishing industry. He failed. The article goes on to talk about another monkey. In September 1953, a young female named Emo figured out that she could rinse the sand off her sweet potatoes by dunking them in a nearby brook. Emo was a primate genius and Edison. Philosophers and scientists confidently offer up traits said to be uniquely human, and the monkeys and apes casually knock them down, toppling the pretension that humans constitute some sort of biological aristocracy among the beings of Earth. Instead, we are incompletely accommodated to our recent exalted state, insecure about who we are and trying to put as much distance as possible between us and our humble origins. It's as if our nearest relatives were a rebuke to the explanations and justifications we offer of our current dominion over the Earth. So as counterweights to human arrogance and pride, it is good for us, at least, that there are still apes on the Earth. Knowing how closely we're related to monkeys and apes, why should we be surprised that the differences are of degree and not of kind? Isn't this a lesson of evolution? In other animals, we can find friendship, altruism, love, fidelity, courage, intelligence, invention, curiosity, forethought, and a host of other characteristics that we humans should be glad to have in greater measure. Those who decry or deny our animal natures underestimate what those natures are. A sharp distinction between human beings and animals is essential if we are to bend them to our will, make them work for us, wear them, eat them, without any disquieting tinges of guilt or regret. Isn't there much to be proud of in the lives of the monkeys and apes? Shouldn't we be glad to acknowledge a connection with Leaky or Emo? Now, they get excited because a chimpanzee can break off a grass stalk and gather termites with it. And it's noteworthy that the chimp can do this better than a human can. You know, there are a lot of things that birds and fish and animals can do better than you and I can. That doesn't prove anything except that an almighty, all-wise God equipped each part of his creation with what it needed. You know, squirrels can climb trees better than you can. Birds can fly better than you can. A one-minute-old antelope can outrun an Olympic track star. One-minute-old antelope. Fish can swim better than you can. Bears can fight better than you can. Mountain goats can climb better than you can. Genesis 1:31 says, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good." God equipped all of his creation with abilities and knowledge and incredible design. To me, at least, what the trapdoor spider does is far more remarkable than an ape being able to catch termites on a grass stalk. And the fact that a young spider that builds a web, those spiders that build webs in different places, a young spider that builds a web will build it perfectly the first time, even when she's never seen another web. Her first web is just as good and just the same as her 10th one. How did she learn that? Here's a quote from a book about bugs. "Bugs are born knowing everything they need to know about getting food, fighting their enemies, and building their houses." And then it goes on to say, "Not even scientists have figured out exactly how a bug knows these things. That is still a bug's secret." Not even scientists, as if that is the epitome of brilliance. Perhaps it's the epitome of arrogance. Jeremiah 17:5 says, "Thus saith the Lord, cursed be the man that trusteth in man, and maketh flesh his arm, and whose heart departeth from the Lord." Deuteronomy 29:29 goes on to tell us the secret things belong unto the Lord our God. The reason the bug has those secrets is because God gave them to him. God designed him. If you're an evolutionist this morning, how do you explain the ant? God himself said that we could gain wisdom from considering the ant. It's interesting that he didn't send us to the ape or the gorilla, the chimpanzee, but to the ant. He said, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest." You know that the ants don't have a president or a congress or a supreme court or a senate, and their little world runs far smoother and more harmoniously than our little world does. Ants live together in big colonies. There are three kinds of ants in every ant city: the egg-laying females, the males, and a group of females called worker ants. The workers are females, but they do not lay eggs. Each kind of ant is born knowing what his life work is, and they don't have to be taught how to do it. When a queen starts laying eggs, for the first few years, she will lay only eggs that hatch workers. For years, she will not hatch males or other females, other queens. Scientists do not understand why, but it's simply because God designed her that way. God understood the needs of even the ant colony. Young ants aren't equipped to take care of themselves early on, so some worker ants are nursemaids. They feed the young. They take them out in the sun for airing out. They keep them clean. And they even help them change their skin when they start to outgrow their old skin. Change their diapers. Other workers spend all their lives cleaning the city and adding new parts to it. They dig tunnels and make the anthills. They are the ones hurrying along with big loads, moving sand to make tunnels and build rooms. Some workers carry loads that weigh hundreds of times more than they do. In fact, they say for a man to carry proportionately as much as an ant can, a man would have to be able to carry a train locomotive on his back and run along with it. Ants are very sanitary. They always have a room that is the city dump. All the trash from the colony is gathered up and hauled to this room. When an ant gets sick, there are ants who will haul him off to a special hospital room where he'll be away from the other healthy ants. When an ant dies, there are ants who haul him away and bury him away from the rest of their buildings. There are ants who are the soldiers and policemen for the colony. They guard the passages day and night. If danger comes, they run through the city warning the other ants by tapping their feelers. When they fight, they shoot streams of stinging liquid at their enemies and bite them with their strong jaws. There are feeder ants who find where the best food is and prepare it and store it in storehouse rooms for the rest of the colony. Some ants get their food from where bees have stored honey. The honey oozes around the trunk, and the ants climb the trunk and gather the honey and carry it home. Since they have no containers for honey, some types of ants have special workers whose only job is to turn themselves into living casks in which to store honey. They gather up the honey that is brought to them and swallow it. They get fatter and fatter and fatter. They get so fat they can hardly move. And then whenever the other ants get hungry, they go to the feeder ants and give them a little honey. Aren't you glad you're not an ant? In some kind of ant colonies, there are farmer ants. They actually gather tiny seeds from the fields and plant them underground. Pretty soon the seeds sprout. Then the farmers bite off the green sprouts, carry the seeds out into the sun to dry, and the seeds turn into sugar. Other ants plant small plants above the ground and keep them well tended. When the plants turn to seed, the farmers harvest the seeds and store them in underground storerooms. There are even kinds of ants that keep cows. Cows are actually aphids, tiny insects that live on the juices of plants. And inside the aphids, these juices turn into a sweet liquid just as the grass real cows eat turns into milk. The aphid milk is called honeydew. When an aphid is full of honeydew, the milker ant milks it, and the ants take it back to their storerooms. Another type of ant is a mushroom farmer. The ant will take pieces of mushroom and plant it in the deepest, dampest, darkest rooms, and then when it begins to grow, the farmer ant snips it and harvests it for the rest of the colony. The ants weed their mushroom beds just as they weed their seed farms to prevent growth of other sorts of plants among their crops. Somehow all of that just seems to be more impressive to me than that a chimpanzee can use a grass stalk to catch termites. In fact, Lord Avebury, a world-famous scientist, wrote, "When we consider the habits of ants, their social organization, their large communities and elaborate habitations, their roadways, they have a fair claim to rank next to man in the scale of intelligence." Now, that poses some serious problems for the theory of evolution. Some serious problems. Because according to the theory of evolution, the ant, the spider, should not have much intelligence at all. But the evolutionist goes right on in his arrogance, pretending to know the answers when he doesn't even understand the questions many times. It's an article again by our famous evolutionist, Carl Sagan. So the methods and ethos of science and religion are profoundly different. Religion frequently asks us to believe without question, even or especially in the absence of hard evidence. Indeed, this is the central meaning of faith. Science asks us to take nothing on faith, to be wary of our penchant for self-deception, to reject anecdotal evidence. Science considers deep skepticism a prime virtue. Religion often sees it as a barrier to enlightenment. So for centuries, there has been a conflict between the two fields, the discoveries of science challenging religious dogmas and religion attempting to ignore or suppress the disquieting findings. That's a lie. Particularly in the area where he's dealing with evolution, which is not scientific at all. It is the evolutionist who seeks to suppress the evidence. It is the evolutionist who over and over again is found guilty of lies and deception and hoaxes. Many times, and many of these hoaxes make it into our science textbooks and into our museums, and they're there for 50, 60, 70 years before they're proved to be a hoax and a fraud and a forgery. The Nebraska man, supposedly that proved evolution. It was all based on the finding of a single tooth. Single tooth. And from that, they create models and skeletons and drawings and paintings of a whole colony of them gathered around a fire roasting some wild animal while the rest of them are out in the field with javelins trying to chase down a woolly mammoth or a saber-toothed tiger or whatever the artist conjures up. And from the finding of a single tooth, They created the Nebraska Man and said this was the missing link. Turned out later to be the tooth of a pig. The Colorado Man, same thing. Proved evolution based on the finding of a single tooth. Turned out later to be the tooth of a horse. The Java Man, supposedly 500,000 years old. And later it was proved that lava flows in the area made it impossible for the skull to be more than 500 years old. Scientists finally admitted that it was just an ordinary ape skull. 35 years after the first find, another so-called missing link skull was found in Java. This was supposedly the real thing. Turned out to be the knee bone of an elephant. But for a while, it proved evolution in their minds. The Piltdown Man. They found some bones, two teeth, a piece of a jaw, and a part of a skull in 1912. And for decades, that was taught as evidence of evolution, the missing link. In 1956, an article appeared in the Reader's Digest that said every important piece proved to be a forgery. The Piltdown Man was a fraud from start to finish. The skull turned out to be the skull of a normal man. The teeth turned out to be in the jawbone of an ape. They'd actually filed down the teeth to make it look like they wanted it to look. 300 replicas of the Piltdown Man were placed in museums all over the world and heralded as the ancestor to modern man. It is estimated that 1 million people a year pass through the American Museum of Natural History in New York to see the so-called ancestor of modern man. And there are millions of people who believe evolution simply because of so-called evidence like this. The Peking Man has been shown to simply be a composite of monkey bones and human bones. They put them together to create the missing link. Hey, if you want to play that game, just take some giraffe bones, elephant bones, rhinoceros bones, and human bones, and you can really make it interesting. You can really come up with a creature. The Zinjanthropus Man was 400 pieces of a skull that they found, a skull in 400 pieces. Supposedly, this was an ape man. Leakey, the finder, claimed that this was an ape man, the missing link. Later, he admitted that it was just an ape. The Castanodolo Man later was proved to be human. The Neanderthal Man, his bones indicated a stooped posture. That's all they needed. That was the missing link. Later, it was proved to be a normal human being that simply suffered from arthritis. Evolutionists make elaborate models and drawings and paintings based on the findings of a single tooth or a jawbone or a forearm bone, one little bone, one fragment of a bone. People act like those are actual photographs, like this somehow proves evolution. Listen to this quote from the encyclopedia. Evolution binds the living world together, and there is no doubt about it. Evolution is a fact. Although it is still conveniently known as the theory of evolution, it has passed the stage of being a working hypothesis and to all intents and purposes has been adequately confirmed as a fact. That's absolute nonsense. In fact, Dr. T.N. Tasminian, a former member of the Atomic Energy Commission, said this, "Scientists who go about teaching that evolution is a fact of life are great con men, and the story they are telling may be the greatest hoax ever. In explaining evolution, we do not have one iota of fact." That's from a scientist. We do not have one iota of fact. In fact, not only do the evolutionists not have one iota of fact to support evolution, there are a lot of facts that contradict evolution and show it to be impossible. Consider the yucca moth. Mexico's warm, sunny climate encourages the growth of many exotic flowers, and one of them is the yucca flower, also called the Spanish bayonet. The plant has dark green leaves with a tall stem growing out of the middle, which is covered with cream-colored yucca flowers. Botanists know that this plant depends on the yucca moth for pollination. The moth happens to be the same color as the flower, which keeps it perfectly camouflaged. The moth picks up little golden granules of pollen from the flower and forms it into a ball about the size of her head. She then flies off in search of another yucca flower, and with deliberate movement, she drops the pollen ball down the stigma tube in the center of the flower right onto the seed-producing ovary. As a result, there's pollination, and the plant will be able to reproduce. The flower needs the moth to reproduce, but the moth also needs the flower. For after the yucca moth releases the pollen ball down the stigma tube, she lays several eggs on it, and as the eggs hatch into grubs, they feed on some of the tubes and some of the seeds in the tube. Neither the moth nor the flower could exist without each other. This is known in biology as symbiosis. Now, if the evolutionist is right, the moth learned this whole process over the period of several hundred thousand years. But you don't have to be too smart to see that both the moth and the flower would have long since become extinct, long before the learning process was complete. They could not have evolved. They had to be created. Another example of symbiosis is the fig wasp and the carpa fig tree and the Calamurna fig tree. Fig wasp is a tiny creature about half the size of a fruit fly. This is the only insect that can pollinate figs, and this is the only way that figs can be pollinated. And yet evolution teaches that plants come along a long time before insects came along. The fig wasp carries pollen from a male caper fig to a female calamurna fig. Her real intention is to lay eggs, but she ends up instead depositing a load of pollen. She flies to another female calamurna fig, searching for a suitable place to lay her eggs. All she does is lay more pollen. The only place that she might find suitable to lay her eggs in will be a male caper fig, similar to the one that she hatched out of. But in visiting those female figs, she pollinates them with the pollen dust of the male fig she was born in. Most of the time, a flower will not grow on the inside of a fruit, but it does with this fig. Fig serves as an incubator for the baby wasp. There's a tiny hole at the base of the fig which allows the wasp to come in and go out. The entire life cycle of the fig wasp, from hatching to pollinating other figs to laying her eggs to dying, takes less than 24 hours. That's right, the fig wasp doesn't even live an entire day. But during that short period of time, she accomplishes everything necessary to producing more figs and more fig wasps. A tree needs the wasp, and the wasp needs the tree. Now, do you think they evolved, or do you think that an all-wise God created them? What about the honeybee? How do you account for this little insect marvel? To manufacture 1 pound of honey, 100,000 bees must travel a distance equal to more than 3 times around the world. Each trip of a worker bee takes between 1 and 1.5 miles. In its lifetime of about 2 months, a worker bee produces about 1/2 teaspoon of honey. Think about that the next time you waste some honey or spill it on the ground. Honey contains iron, lime, sodium, sulfur, magnesium, phosphoric acid, levulose, and dextrose. High amounts of vitamin A, vitamin B, vitamin C. Honey is very easily assimilated into the human body. Before cane sugar can be absorbed into our bloodstream, it has to go through, it has to be changed by a digestive process into a kind of honey. Honey doesn't need to go through all these digestive processes. When a honeybee comes to a flower, she pushes her tube-like tongue into the base of the flower and pumps up the nectar. A miniature pipeline carries the nectar to her storage tank or stomach. Honeybees actually have 2 stomachs. They're connected by a valve which the bee can open or close at will, depending on whether the bee wants the honey for itself or to store in the hive. Actually, as the bee is flying back to the hive with a full load of nectar, which is just 1 drop, her body is transforming that nectar into honey. Some of that honey, a very small amount, is used for flight fuel along the way. It has been calculated that bees get about 4 million miles per gallon of honey. That's pretty good fuel economy. Both that will drip into the bee's mouth and from there be pumped into the bee's stomach, turning nectar sugar water into mineral-rich honey. And as the worker comes back to the hive, a guard bee checks her to make sure she's a member of the swarm. In the summer, the hive temperature is maintained at 94 degrees Fahrenheit. If the temperature gets to 95 degrees, then the bees cool the hive by fanning their wings and spreading water on the combs, and the water evaporates and cools the hive until it gets back down to 94 degrees. In the winter, if the temperature drops to 57 degrees or lower, the bees stay inside their hive and huddle together in a mass, rotating from the inside of the circle to the outside, keeping warm from their combined body warmth. It takes teamwork or they would all die. The worker bee brings her drop of honey. She deposits it into a honey cell. When the cell is full, the workers will cap it with a wax that they manufacture. Glands on their abdomen produce flakes of wax. They grab the wax flakes with their feet and put it in their mouths. They then chew it up into pellets, which are then used to cap the honey. Wax cells are made the same way. This wax floats on water and can endure temperatures of 140 degrees Fahrenheit before melting, much higher than normal wax can. The 6-sided cells that are manufactured with this wax are marvels of engineering. They tell us that they are built in such a way as to achieve maximum strength. The little honeybee has never been to school, and yet is a marvel in construction, engineering, being a nurse, being a chemist, heating, air conditioning, manufacturing, design, botany, and on and on and on. The wings of a honeybee beat 190 times per second and are wonderfully made. Even bees' knees, believe it or not, are also wonderfully made, and the bee literally could not have survived while even that one small feature evolved. Evolution is impossible. How do you account for the bombardier beetle if evolution is true? When threatened or attacked, this beetle emits a spray of noxious liquid to ward off its enemies. This corrosive discharge can be fired as many as 20 times in rapid succession. Now, how did this beetle keep from being destroyed? How does it keep from being destroyed by its own liquid? It has within its body an antitoxin which protects it from its own defense mechanism. Now, which evolved first? It would have no need of the antitoxin until the toxin evolved. But if the toxin evolved first, that would have killed it. Beetle would die without the antitoxin. So which evolved first, and how so? How about the earthworm? The earthworm has five hearts. Now, following evolution's theory, it obviously had only 1 heart to start with. It's easy to understand its need for extra hearts. Just dig in your garden for a while. It's easy to chop those little guys in half. Now, if they were harmful to your garden, you wouldn't mind that. But they're not. They're beneficial. In fact, earthworm dirt, they eat dirt and they turn it to the ground greatly improved. The average earthworm produces 1/2 pound of the world's best plant food in a year. In 1 acre of good garden dirt, the earthworms therein can eat, digest, and manufacture 15 tons of rich plant food in a year. 15 tons a year. In Connecticut, agricultural scientists tried an experiment. They took 2 similar plots of ground, and in one they plowed rich organic materials into the soil. In the other plot of ground, they let earthworms do their work. After a period of time, they tested the soil. Man's best versus earthworm's best. Here's what they found. The earthworm's plot of ground had 5 times more nitrogen, 2 times more calcium, 2.5 times more magnesium, 7 times more phosphorus, and 11 times more potassium. All of these nutrients are beneficial to soil and plants. No one could deny that fertilizer factories are designed by architects and engineers, and that expert scientists help ensure that the factory produces good products because of careful design and years of research. But a far more efficient and beneficial fertilizer factory that has been designed to not only help the earth, but also produce more little fertilizer factories. We think that happened by chance. Consider again his 5 hearts. If he started with 1 heart, as he must have, if evolution is correct, how did he get 5? If you're an earthworm and you get chopped in half when you only have one heart, obviously the half without a heart will die. There's not time to evolve a new one. It's all over for your half. The half with the heart isn't going to think he needs another heart. Man, he's got a heart. He needs a tail. So how did he get 5 hearts? God gave him 5 when he created him. Why is man so afraid to acknowledge God as creator? Why is man so afraid of that? Why does that make him fear and tremble? Why does that make him irrational? Why do you get all excited about a chimpanzee taking a blade of grass and gathering termites with it? Or you think that somehow that shows tremendous tool-making ability, tremendous intelligence. And he ignores the ant and the honeybee and the trapdoor spider. Why? Psalms 100, verse 3, "Know ye not that the Lord, He is God? It is He that hath made us, and not we ourselves, we are His people, and the sheep of His pasture." And therein lies the crux of the matter. As soon as you acknowledge that you were made by God, then it becomes apparent He has claims on your life.